We're going to pick up in Matthew chapter 12. We're talking about Jesus, obviously, in the life of Christ. But what day of the week are the events that are happening right now happening on? It's the Sabbath day. In John chapter 5, what transpired on the Sabbath day in John chapter 5 that we already studied? No, that's where we're at now in Matthew 12. In John 5, yeah, right. So he healed the lame man who had been lame for 38 years, and the initial accusation was against the lame man for doing what on the Sabbath?
Carrying
his pallet. And then they turned their attention to the one who had actually healed him and told him that he could carry and should carry his pallet on the Sabbath day. So they turned to against Christ in terms of giving him the command to carry his pallet on the Sabbath day. And we talked about the rest of John chapter 5, answering the question that the Pharisees in essence asked of him of, who do you think you are? And then he cited the evidence of who he claimed to be. We then move on to Matthew chapter 12. But again, as Carolyn noted, we're taking a look at the context in which on the Sabbath day, Jesus' disciples were walking through the grain field and they picked the heads of grain. And the Pharisees had accused them of, again, in essence, doing what on the Sabbath day?
Working
and
harvesting
crops on the Sabbath day. And so we talked a little bit last week, and we're going to review just real quick what we covered about the Sabbath last Wednesday night, and then we'll proceed in this context. All right, so Matthew chapter 12, let's once again read the context of Matthew 12 verses 1 through 8, if I get someone to volunteer for that. Randy?
Matthew 12, 1 through 8. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the heads of grain and eat. But when the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." But he said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he became hungry, he and his companions, how he entered the house of God, and they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but for the priests alone? Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent? But I say to you that something greater than the temple is here. But if you had known what this means, 'I desire compassion and not a sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath."
All right, so last week, and I appreciate you allowing me to take a little time to stop and take a look at the Sabbath day. And we took a look at the Sabbath in the Old Testament. We took a look at the passages in Exodus chapter 16, Exodus chapter 20, Deuteronomy chapter 5, and that talked about what the Sabbath was for and the institution of it. But we talked about how that, again, over time, the Israelites had done what regarding the Sabbath? Neglected it, profaned it, again, despised it. And we come then, after Babylonian captivity, we came to the period of the restoration in which they came back to the land. And Nehemiah found that they had, there were kind of three things that were going on. What were they still doing regarding their children?
They were still allowing them to intermarry.
Okay, so they were still intermarrying with the people. What was the condition of the temple? It was broken down. They had to take care of it. They had to take care of their homes, but not the temple. And again, had they taken care of the Sabbath day in terms of treating it as the holy day it should be?
No.
And so we read how that in Nehemiah chapter 10, how that Nehemiah talks with the people. We go back to chapter 8 in which they read the law. In Nehemiah chapter 10, we pointed out last week how that Nehemiah says, here's the three things we're going to agree to do. We're going to stop giving our sons and daughters in marriage to foreign people. We're going to begin to observe the Sabbath day as God instructed us to do. And then what were they going to do regarding the temple? We're going to start to pay our temple tax, and we're going to take care of the temple of God as we should. And we talked about how that, again, an appropriate response to their neglect to all three aspects of God's law. But by the time we get to the New Testament times, with the time during the time of Christ, they had swung the pendulum at all three things. that regarding giving their sons and daughters in marriage, they weren't doing it that anymore, but what were they not doing also? They wouldn't even speak to them. They wouldn't even talk to, you know, to the Gentiles any longer. In regards to the Sabbath day, we talked about how that again, they not only now were observing the Sabbath day, but they had gone far beyond that in terms of establishing their own laws about the Sabbath. And the 39 things that they came up with that they decided were, again, unlawful on the Sabbath. Then we talk about the temple and how that, again, they had swung the pendulum to the point that they, again, Matthew 23, they were no longer neglecting the tithes that they were supposed to do, but they had lost the weightier matters of the law that were supposed to accompany them. And they would swear by the gold on the temple, but that was what was truly important to them. So we talked about those three things, and that kind of set the context then for here we are at the time of Christ, and how did they get to the point where they were, again, bending over so far backwards on the Sabbath day? But indeed, they had. And so we come here to Matthew chapter 12, and now Jesus is on here upon the Sabbath day, and his disciples are picking the heads of grain and eating them. And we talked about the fact that, again, under the old law, was it unlawful for someone to go through someone else's field and pick a head of grain with their hands?
No,
that was simply considered gleaning in the fields. They could do that with one another's grapes or any other products. That was not considered harvesting or reaping. They were simply, again, going through and addressing the hunger, picking the heads of grain. Now, throughout the scriptures, and not only here, we're going to see in the very next context beyond Matthew 12, 1 through 8, but again, Jesus makes some points about the Sabbath day. Here, his disciples picking the heads of grain and eating them. Again, the next context we will come to is where Jesus healed a man with a withered hand upon the Sabbath day. And again, he's trying to get them to understand some things about the Sabbath day. Luke chapter 13, when we get there, we'll read about a woman who had been 18 years, as it were, bent over, doubled over in a condition, and he healed that woman, and yet they were condemning him for doing that as well. And again, John chapter 9, we made the point that, again, he healed a man who was born blind on the Sabbath day. And again, they were critical of that. Now, when they criticized him about, again, here in Matthew chapter 12, about his disciples picking the heads of grain, again, he has some arguments not only here that we're going to study, but what were some of the basic arguments that Jesus gave towards those who criticized his healing and the other miracles he performed on the Sabbath? For example, when we look at Luke chapter 13, and let's go over and look at Luke 13, verses 15 and 16, if I can get someone to read those two verses for us. Luke 13, 15 and 16. Leonardo, you had your hand up earlier. Can I?
Oh, whoa.
Oh.
I wasn't ready just now.
Oh. Luke 13, 15 and 16. Luke 13, 15?
That's not Luke 13? You mean chapter 13?
Yeah, Luke chapter 13, verse 15.
Verse 15. I'm sorry. Okay. But the Lord answered him and said, "You hypocrites, does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the stall and lead him away to water him? And this woman, the daughter of Abraham, as she is, whom Satan has bound for 18 long years, should she not have been released from this bond on the Sabbath day?"
So what's his argument here?
Say what?
Yeah, you take care of your animals. You take care of him, and an oxen to those at that time, was that a pet?
No.
No, it was a source of I mean, livelihood, wasn't it? I mean, they didn't have oxen for any other purpose other than to give, for their work, for their business. And would they take care of their oxen on the Sabbath day? But Jesus says, how much more should I not take care of this woman who had been in this condition for so long? If you look at Luke chapter 14, I get somebody to read verse 5. Luke 14, verse 5. Carol?
And he said to them, which of you will have a son or an ox fall into a well and will not immediately pull him out on a Sabbath day?
All right, so again, the same type of thing, but this time even bringing in the fact of one of your own family members. If you had a son who, again, had fallen into a well, had fallen into a ditch, it's a Sabbath day. Are you going to leave him there? No. But yet you're going to criticize Jesus for healing someone on the Sabbath day. You rescue your son or ox who fell into the well. You condemn the healing of the one who had been suffering from dropsy. And finally, John chapter 7, verse 23. Can I get someone to read that? John 7, 23? Leah?
If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because I make an entire man well on the Sabbath?
All right, so again, when they perform circumcision on the Sabbath to keep the law of Moses. Yes. But again, and was that necessary? Was that appropriate? But is it not appropriate then to, as Jesus says, to make an entire man well on the Sabbath day? All right, so those are some of the other circumstances. We'll study those in their context more fully. But let's go back here to Matthew chapter 12, because really in this context, I believe there's about six different arguments or points that Jesus wants to make regarding their picking of the grain upon the Sabbath day. And the first of these is in Matthew chapter 12 and in verse 3. When he said to them, have you not read what David did when he became hungry, he and his companions, how he entered the house of God and they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priests alone. So he cites an example of what happened to, or something David did, and that points us back to 1 Samuel chapter 21. And if I can read, if I can get somebody to read verses 1 through 6 of 1 Samuel 21. Jenny, thank you.
Then David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech came to meet David, trembling, and said to him, why are you alone and no one with you? And David said to Ahimelech the priest, the king has charged me with a matter, and said to me, let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you, and with which I have charged you. I have made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread for whatever is here. And the priest answered David, I have no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread, if the young men have kept themselves from women. And David answered the priest, truly women have been kept from us, as always when I go on an expedition. The vessels of the young men are holy, even when it is an ordinary journey. How much more today will their vessels be holy? So the priest gave him the holy bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which is removed from before the Lord to be replaced by hot bread on the day it is taken away.
All right. So we read here, this is what Jesus was talking about in Matthew chapter 12. And he says, haven't you read what David did upon the Sabbath day? How he entered the temple and ate what Jesus said was not lawful for him to eat. Now, what exactly was this law about this holy bread? Well, let's turn back to Leviticus chapter 24 in regards to what the law said about this bread. Luke chapter 24, verses 5 through 9. Again, I get somebody to volunteer to read that. John?
And thou shalt take fine flour and bake 12 cakes thereof. 2 tenth deals shall be in 1 cake, and thou shalt set them in 2 rows, 6 in a row upon your table before the Lord. And thou shalt put pure frankincense upon each row, that it may be on the bread for a memorial, even an offering made by fire unto the Lord. Every Sabbath you shall set it in order before the Lord continually, being taken from the children of Israel by an everlasting covenant. And it shall be Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in the holy place, for it is the most holy unto him of the offerings of the Lord made by fire, by a perpetual statute.
All right, so John, upon the Sabbath day, what were the priests to do regarding this bread?
What were they to do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, true. But before they did that, every Sabbath day they would bake new bread, wouldn't they?
Yes.
And they would lay it out in the three rows of four, right? Two rows of six, okay. And again, did it, that matter to God? He specified it, didn't he? So two rows of six. And so every Sabbath day, they'd bake this bread, put it in two rows of six. What would they put on the bread?
Frankincense.
And then the week-old bread, now, that they had baked the prior Sabbath day, as John pointed out, who was entitled to eat that bread? Aaron and his sons. Aaron being the
high priest.
Any other provisions for anybody else to eat that bread? Okay. So this is what Jesus is talking about in Matthew chapter 12. He's talking about David, and we read that again in 1 Samuel chapter 21. So was it lawful for David to eat that bread?
It wasn't.
Jesus said it wasn't, and when we read from Leviticus, did the law say it was lawful for David to eat that bread? No. So what's the point that Jesus is making here in Matthew chapter 12? When you think about David in the eyes of the Pharisees, how did they regard David?
On a pedestal.
I'm sorry?
On a pedestal.
On a pedestal. I mean, other than Moses and Abraham and David, those were as it were the Mount Rushmore of you know Jewish history. They revered David. Were the Pharisees ever criticized David for anything he ever did?
Surely not.
I'm sorry?
Surely not.
No, yeah. They would revere David. They would honor David. David in their eyes again was the great king of Israel. But he did something that was not lawful. He shouldn't have done that. But they didn't criticize him. But what's the point Jesus is making? But now you criticize who? My disciples. For doing something that was lawful on the Sabbath day. They weren't harvesting the grain. They were simply, again, gleaning it. You won't criticize David, but you criticize my disciples for doing... And again, notice in Matthew chapter 12... Where the, what did he say in verse 7 regarding his disciples at the end of that verse? What had they done to his disciples at the end of that verse? They had condemned the innocent. And yet you again overlook, again, other transgressions that they were willing to overlook, but you will not, again, you will condemn the innocent for doing what is lawful.
Okay, so now, did God just cut David some slack, or what David did, was it not wrong?
Well, it was wrong. Again, did David,
wrong.
Did David commit other sins in his life?
Well, okay.
Yeah. So, again, it's not to say that what David did was right. And interestingly enough here, I think one of the points is, and I read people as they commented on this passage, they would say, well, see, this is Jesus teaching the point that the human needs sometimes supersede God's laws. That they I read of some who actually justified what David did and say it was okay because of the need of the moment. And I reject that. And I think Jesus here is making the point that it's not about man's needs superseding God's law. It is about their hypocrisy, about them not being consistent with what they say.
Humanism.
Yeah. Again, this is situation ethics, right? That some would say, well, again, if your need is strong enough, then it's okay to set aside God's law. No, that's not true. It is not okay to set aside God's law. It's not okay to say that my needs at the moment supersede what God has to say. No, Jesus said of his actions, again of David, it was not lawful for him to eat. What he's trying to establish here is, again, you're not being consistent. And again, do we ever see that within even the church today regarding the law of Christ? That when sometimes it hits home, do we find sometimes perhaps preachers and teachers and members of the Lord's church not being consistent in terms of, again, teaching others what they need to do? But again, when it comes to, again, our own personal situation, that we will not perhaps, again, condemn a family member or someone that's close to us.
All right? One question. So do we have situations in which David does wrong and there's no sense of the condemnation in the context, or we don't get any message from a prophet or from a narrator that what he's done is wrong?
Well, I mean, certainly this situation, Jesus himself says it was, you know, wrong for him to do. Again, I'm not sure I'm prepared to go through the entire life of David to find another instance where he committed sin that was not, again, publicly rebuked. But again, the point is Jesus makes it very clear that was not lawful for him to do that. And again, that was not right for him to set that aside. So when we think about this first argument, Jesus says, number one, regarding the Sabbath day, you're being hypocrites. You're simply not being consistent in your application of the Sabbath. Number two, what else does he cite here in Matthew chapter 12 and in verse 5?
Since there are certain works that are commanded to be done on Sabbath.
Exactly. And by who?
By the priest.
The priest. Could the priest refrain from doing their work upon the Sabbath because God said don't work on the Sabbath?
There were sacrifices that were specifically required upon the Sabbath.
Absolutely. Can somebody read for us Numbers chapter 28, verses 9 and 10? Numbers 28, 9 and 10. Anybody? Mick, thank you.
Verse 9, on the Sabbath day, 2 he lambs, a year old, without blemish, 2/10 parts of a heap of fine flour for a meal offering mingled with oil, and the drink offering thereof. This is the burnt offering of every Sabbath, besides the continual burnt offering, and the drink offerings thereof.
So they were to offer sacrifice upon the Sabbath day. And surely within one of their 39 definitions, that would have fit somewhere, would it not? But Jesus here again is making the point, again, you're being inconsistent. To understand that there are some works that are commanded upon the Sabbath. Luke chapter 24, we read of earlier, what else were they to do upon the Sabbath? We read about that. That's the bread. They were again to bake the bread and to put out the 12 new loaves and to take out the 12 loaves from the week before. So again, God's word does not contradict itself. Again, there are works to be done upon the Sabbath day, and they're not being consistent with that. Further in Matthew chapter 12, he goes on to say in that context that there is something greater. Verse 6, but I say to you that something greater than the temple is here. Something greater than the temple. Who is he talking about? What is he talking about? Talking about himself. Then again, we talk about how that they revered the temple. Let's turn to, again, Haggai chapter 2, verses 7 through 9. How many of you are doing the whole song in your head as we get to the minor prophets? Is that tonight? Haggai, is that correct? Okay. Haggai chapter 2, verses 7 through 9. Somebody, James, do you have that for us?
7:39. And I will shake all nations, and the precious things of all nations shall come. And I will fill this house with glory, saith Jehovah of hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith Jehovah of hosts. The latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former, saith Jehovah of hosts. And in this place will I give peace, saith Jehovah of hosts.
So again, in historically, James, where are we with Haggai?
Well, Haggai's getting the people, trying to get the people fired up to get the temple built. Because they're more worried about their house during the restoration of the land. They're more worried about getting their own homes built than getting God's temple reconstructed and getting the wall built. So Haggai's telling them, you need to get the temple built and you need to do it now.
But then in these verses, what's he talking? He's saying there's something more important coming, isn't it? And he said again, verse 9, that the latter glory of this house will be greater than the former, says the Lord of hosts. And in this place I will give peace, declares the Lord of hosts. Again, I believe very clearly talking about, again, the Messiah. That indeed, the greater glory is here. Someone greater than the temple is here. And again, what's the peace that Haggai is prophesying about that would come when this greater glory would come?
Well, that's going to be spiritual peace.
Spiritual peace, yeah. Isn't that fascinating? Again, something greater than the temple will come. Something more glorious is going to be here. And again, that is Christ. In Malachi chapter 3, again, just a few pages over. Malachi chapter 3 and in verse 1, Behold, I am going to send my messenger, and he will clear the way before me. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, and the messenger of the covenant whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. Again, the prophecy about the Christ who would come and to come into his temple. John chapter 1 and verse 14, as we studied already, in the preface of the Gospel of John, John chapter 1, verse 14, And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw His glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. Indeed, the glory of the Son of God was greater than any physical structure that man could build unto God. And they needed to recognize that something greater than the temple was here. And then finally, Hebrews chapter 3, and in verse 3, again, beginning of verse 1, Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider Jesus the apostle and high priest of our confession. He was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was in all his house. For he has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, just by so much as the builder of the house has more honor than the house. Again, all the glory and honor goes to Jesus. Something greater than the physical structure was now there. And they needed to recognize the glory of the Lord, and that something greater than the temple was here. Number four. In terms of his points or his arguments to the Pharisees and their criticism, he says in verse 7, But if you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not a sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. If you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not sacrifice. What's his point here? What had they done in terms of temple worship at this time? Did they emphasize coming to offer the right worship in the right way, with the right heart, with the right attitude? I'm sorry?
Very legalistic.
Very legalistic.
Cross the T's and don't worry about anything else.
Alright. And did they do some of the acts again? When we think about Matthew 23:23, when they were tithing mint and dill and coming to Jesus, says you shouldn't have tithed those things and given the tenth? You should have done that, plus, what were the three things he mentions?
Justice, mercy.
Jesse, mercy, and faithfulness. You shouldn't have left those undone without practicing justice, mercy, and faithfulness. So again, we read in Hosea chapter 6 and verse 6, beginning in verse 4 of Hosea 6, he says, "What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? For your loyalty is like a morning cloud and like the dew which goes away early. Therefore, I have hewn them in pieces by the prophets. I have slain them by the mouth, by the words of my mouth. And the judgments on you are like the light that goes forth. For I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice, and in the knowledge of God rather than in burnt offerings." Again, did they offer burnt offerings back then? Yeah. But how loyal were they to God? They didn't draw near with a whole heart. Again, he described their loyalty in verse 4 as what? Your loyalty is like a morning cloud. It's that cloud you see when you first get up, and then a couple hours it's gone. It doesn't stay around. He says your loyalty is like that. You offer sacrifices, but you know what I want in addition to your sacrifices? So again, in verse 6, I want your loyalty. And I want the knowledge of God rather than just offering sacrifices. Again, we turn to the New Testament in Matthew chapter 9. Again, in verses 10 through 13. If I can get somebody to read Matthew 9, 10 through 13. Richard?
Matthew 9, verse 10. "And it came to pass as he sat at meat in the house, behold, many publicans and sinners came and sat down with Jesus and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto his disciples, Why eateth your teacher with the publicans and sinners? But when he heard it, he said, They that are whole have no need of a physician, but they that are sick. But go ye and learn what this meaneth. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, for I came not to call the righteous, but sinners."
So we see here Jesus quoting Hosea 6:6, and he applies it to what context? Jesus is dining with the publicans, and the Pharisees viewed publicans, we've talked about this before, as some of the worst people on earth. You just don't associate with people like that. So not only did they not associate with Gentiles, but we won't even associate with Jews who we deem unworthy of our attention. We won't have any compassion on them. We won't, you know, see any need to try to reach out to those who are sinners. And again, he quotes Hosea 6:6 to say, what God desires on our part is compassion for those who are lost in sin. Look at, again, 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 22. What's the context of 1 Samuel 15?
The destruction, the supposed destruction of the Amalekites.
Okay. But what had Saul done? He had spared
foregone that.
The best of the flock. And what was Saul's purpose, or what was Saul's rationale in his mind as to why he spared the best of the flock? Oh, yeah, I disobeyed you, Lord, but here's the reason why. I did it because I wanted to take this best of the flocks and offer to you, Lord. And again, what do we read in 1 Samuel 15, verse 22? Okay, and the... Okay. So again, what I want from you is your reverence, is your respect, to do what I ask you to do it with a whole heart, to do it with loyalty, to have compassion. That is what I'm looking for from you. And again, if Jesus says, if you had known what this means, that I desire compassion and not a sacrifice, you would not condemn the innocent. Again, their worship unto God had become very superficial, very external, very ritualistic. What was God looking for from them? Worship from the heart. Worship that was sincere, reverential.
It's interesting that in both the Matthew 8:13 and this passage, in both of those, he accuses them of not knowing what that means.
Yeah.
Referencing is if they know where the verse is, they just don't know what it means.
Well, and that's one thing to know where it is. It's another thing to understand its application in our lives, isn't it? Yeah.
And then in Matthew 15, we have where he's condemning them the same, kind of along the same lines, but it's where he's condemning them for teaching as precepts. things of men rather than God's law, and it's talking about how they transgress the commandments of God for the sake of their traditions.
Right.
Where they don't honor their parents because they say that they're, whatever they would have used to support their parents, they're going to give that to the temple. So they say that that is in place
or excused
instead of both.
The interesting thing that I've noticed throughout studying the Bible is that the worship of God is not any different in the Old Testament and the New Testament when it comes right down to really what God wants. We have a tendency to think that the Old Testament law was just completely ritualistic. Check marks in the box.
Yeah.
You know, all the boxes have been checked. But when Jesus used Matthew 23:23, he wasn't talking about the gospel. He was talking about the way they should have lived their lives always. And when we look at these verses in Hosea and Samuel and Psalms and realize that they're talking about the same thing that Jesus is talking about, I think we have to understand that God didn't change it. Man changed, which is why we've been pointing out the whole time. Because man changed the whole thing.
Right. And again, did the specific aspects of worship change from the Old Law to the New Law? Yeah, but the heart that God is looking for, yeah, I've heard people say, well, God wasn't concerned about the heart in the Old Testament. Yes, he was. He's always been concerned about man's heart. Again, you go back to the selection of King David. Why did he pick David? Because he looked at the heart. And so again, the aspect that our worship starts where? Where in Matthew 15 says everything starts in our heart. You know, both sin and reverence and worship starts with the heart, with loyalty, with compassion, with mercy, with the divine attributes. So again, that's what Jesus is talking about here, about their lack of sincere, reverential, heartfelt worship. Dave?
You know, it's interesting in what Richard said and what you're talking about now, that if you look at Matthew 19, why all this happens when he's talking about the marriage divorce and remarriage. Because he tells them that from the beginning it was not so. But because of the hardness of your heart, God gave, you know, told Moses to give you a written decree of divorce.
Yeah.
But it was because of their hardness.
Yeah, again, you pointed out how that, again, or somebody did tonight about, again, have you not learned what this means? Other times we've pointed out that Jesus will use the expression, have you not read? And again, here you talk about Matthew 19:9 about, he says, have you not read in the beginning how that God originally established? And again, God wanted, you know, man to know what he said, to know what it meant, and to know how to apply it. And again, in many times, man just failed to do any of those.
The list that you have, they're heartfelt, sincere, reverential, along with that goes humble. If a person is that way, they're going to want to please God. They're going to want to obey him, and the rest takes care of itself.
Yes, absolutely. Again, we will worship him as he desires to be worshipped, again, with those attitudes. And yeah, I should have put it in there with humility. Absolutely. So again, if you had known what this means, you wouldn't have condemned the innocent. The next point, going back to Matthew chapter 12, again, he says, let's look at Mark chapter 2. In Mark chapter 2, verse 27, again, that he adds a point that Matthew does not. Verse 27, it says, Jesus said to them, the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. What was the point of the Sabbath day? To put ropes around this one day of the week and to make that day the object of their focus and attention? The Sabbath day, we talked about this last week. What's the whole point of the Sabbath day? I'm sorry?
To remember God.
to remember God, to worship God, to it was to be a holy day, a day of reverence to Him, and to a day of to remember the covenant that they have with their Father in heaven. It was the Sabbath was made for it was for man, for His people, to remember His holiness, to remember God and their relationship to Him. The Sabbath was to be man's spiritual benefit and to honor God. Look at Mark chapter 2. We did from Mark chapter 2, verse 27. So, again, had they gotten the cart before the horse here? Very much so. Again, they had, again, made the Sabbath day the object of the reverence and not God who had made that for man's benefit. And then finally, going back to Matthew chapter 12, the sixth point here from verse 8, where Jesus says, "For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." What does the word Lord mean? I'm sorry?
Master.
What did you say?
Boss.
Okay. So it's from the word kurios, which means supreme in authority and power, one worthy of honor, reverence, and respect. Does that sound about right? Is that our Lord in terms of supreme in authority and power and worthy of our reverence and respect? He is Lord, and He's Lord of the Sabbath. But who did the Pharisees believe was the Lord of the Sabbath? They thought they were. Again, remember the man who picked up the pallet and walked on the Sabbath day. What did they ask him? Who told you and who gave you this authority to do so? They viewed themselves as the Lord. You establish 39 rules for the Sabbath day if you don't think that you have the authority, the power, and the right to define what gets done on the Sabbath day. Jesus reminds these Pharisees, I am Lord of the Sabbath, not you. God is the one, again, who designed the Sabbath day for your spiritual benefit, for your remembrance of your relationship with the Lord. It's not you who decides what gets done on the Sabbath day.
Well, I suspect that the way of Jesus saying that He was God.
Well, But again, I'm sure they fully understood what He was saying here. You know, that He had authority over the Sabbath day. Because, did they remember who gave the Sabbath day to them? Yeah. You know, they knew their history. They knew that, again, you go back to, you know, Moses in the wilderness, that God gave the Sabbath day to them, and Jesus is now saying, I am the Lord of the Sabbath. Right.
The passage of Mark 2:28 reads just a little bit different. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath.
Okay.
So it's not just the Son of Man.
He is Lord.
Man is Lord.
He is Lord.
Even of the Sabbath. Yeah.
Meaning He's Lord of all.
He's Lord of all.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to mention was the 39 rules you were talking about. That makes Matthew 23 make so much more sense, because those Pharisees who were actually keeping those 39 laws, you know, that they were very meticulous about making sure that they kept those so that they could appear more righteous than everybody else.
Yeah.
We're so good, we can even go beyond what God's commanded and we can fulfill our own commands. We've got 39 new commands that we're keeping ourselves. And if nobody else can keep them, that makes us even more righteous.
Well, have there been religions since then that have come along with people who have said, you need to follow me rather than the scriptures?
Many.
Yeah. So, again, I think it's interesting that he kind of ends this conversation to say, and again, I appreciate you pointing that out from Mark 2, that I am Lord, even of the Sabbath. It was not only, they not only understood that Jesus was talking about Himself as being Lord, but He also understood that He was talking about them and who they were not.
And what did he have to say again about their titles? That they were very focused on titles, weren't they? And Jesus said, "Call no man
Father."
Yeah. Again, that's not for man to presume that role today, then, or ever. Jesus is Lord, even of the Sabbath. One other interesting thing I want to go back to address real quick from this passage, because I thought it was just interesting. We're not going to spend much time on it. But verse 6 again from Matthew 12, "But I say to you, something greater than the temple is here." Again, when you study the book of Hebrews, well, it's one of the comparative words that Hebrews uses a lot.
Better.
But in this context, four times in this and the previous chapter, Jesus affirms his superiority to things that the Jews held dear. First of all, you go back to chapter 11, verse 11, and Jesus talks about the fact that he's greater than John the Baptist. John the Baptist was regarded as a prophet. However, John's purpose was to prepare the way for Jesus. But again, Jesus says someone greater than John the Baptist is here. We go to chapter 12, verse 6 in this context, that he was greater than the temple. Again, they held the temple with great honor and regard as a place of worship. They didn't respect it in terms of, again, turning it into a place of merchandise, but again, they gave great lip service, as it were, to the temple. Again, Jesus, however, is the object of our worship. He is greater than the temple. Drop down to 12, verse 41. In chapter 12, verse 41, Jesus says there, "The men of Nineveh will stand up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it because they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And behold, something greater than Jonah is here." Again, Jonah was one who no doubt the Israelites would recognize as someone who preached and motivated even the nation to like Nineveh to repent. Do we recognize that someone greater than Jonah in terms of a preacher of God's will is here? The superiority of his message and the messenger compared to Jonah. And then finally, chapter 12, verse 42, the very next verse, where it says, "The queen of the south will rise up with this generation as the judgment will condemn it, because she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, something greater than Solomon is here." Again, who did the Jews see as the most wise man upon the earth ever? Solomon. Jesus says, "There's someone wiser now standing in your midst." So again, I think it's interesting that again, Jesus talks four times about something greater than what they held dear. Next time, we're going to move on, if you would, read Matthew chapter 12, verses 9 through 14. We're going to study that context next week. And not only verses 9 through 14, but read all the way down through verse 21, actually, in Matthew chapter 12. And we'll cover that, Lord willing, next Wednesday.